You are listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com. You're listening to The Legal Help Desk with Salar Atrazadeh, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Legal Help Desk. As most listeners know, we talk about legal principles, recent cases, and updates on this exclusive radio program. Today, my guest is attorney Dan Weintraub, and we plan to talk about bankruptcy laws and related issues, such as debt negotiation and asset protection. Please bear in mind that our discussions are for general purposes only and are not intended to create an attorney-client relationship. The law is complicated, and you should consult with a qualified attorney before taking legal action. Please make sure you don't disclose confidential information during the program. You may call us on the air at 818-602-4929 for your questions. You should also visit my law firm's website, atrazadeh.com, and click on podcast to listen to archived interviews. You can download them through iTunes or Stitcher.com under the News and Politics category. Mr. Weintraub has been a licensed attorney in Southern California for over 25 years. He has served as the managing partner of several law firms and is currently the founder and managing partner of Weintraub and Self, a law firm specializing in business reorganizations and personal bankruptcy. His practice focuses on helping businesses and individuals who are in financial trouble and need asset protection. He's helped save thousands of small and mid-sized businesses by providing strategies for business owners and negotiating settlements with the trading, banking, and taxing authorities, including the Internal Revenue Service. Dan was chosen as a super lawyer for five consecutive years from 2009 through 2013. He earned his bachelor's degree with the highest honors in 1982, from UCLA, and in 1987, he received his law degree from USC. Dan, thank you for being on today's program. How are you?
I'm great, Solar. Great to be here with you. It's a beautiful day in Southern California.
It is. You know, a day does not pass that I don't appreciate the weather, because I was, over the holidays, I was in Europe, and it was a bit colder there. And I did miss LA's weather, and believe it or not, I did actually miss the traffic, too. Which is hard to believe.
Yeah, well, it's, like so many things, it's part of our lives out here in Southern California. But when we look at what's going on across the country and how cold it seems to be everywhere, but here it seems like paradise, even with the traffic.
It is, and when you don't lose something until you basically lose it, you don't appreciate it. So when you go, let's say, to the East Coast or somewhere that has more congestion, more smog, more traffic, then you come back to L.A. and you literally worship the ground that people walk on.
Right. We have to be careful. We don't want too many more people coming out here to the East Coast and filling up the roads even more.
Right. Let me take that back then. So, Dan, I think it's important for us to outline today's discussions. We spoke before today's program and emphasize on the fact that bankruptcy with each chapter filing. And I think it's important to have you here to talk about who are your typical clients, why do you practice bankruptcy law, what are the pros and cons of basically doing what you do. So going back to my first question, who are your typical clients?
My typical clients are mid-sized and small businesses
and business owners and individuals who are having financial difficulty. Mm-hmm. So, you know, on the business side, it can be we've represented many real estate developers and contractors that have, you know, really been crushed as a result of the, you know, downturn in the real estate market of several years ago. We've represented small businesses with as little as maybe just a hair under $1 million a year in revenue, and then upwards of several hundred million dollars in revenue. So we've really, on the business side, represented small businesses and what I consider to be pretty big businesses. And then individuals, you know, people run into all sorts of financial problems, very typically as a result of a business failure. Often people start a new business and they fund it with credit cards and borrowings. And, you know, if the business does not succeed, and often that's due to circumstances outside the control of the business owner, mm-hmm. That leads to severe financial pressure and problems. Often we have situations where people have a medical issue in a family, mm-hmm. And you've got uninsured medical bills, which are just astronomical. And while the hospitals and the doctors will often work with you, you know, you're talking about a huge number, which in terms of dollars owed, which really most people can never afford to realistically pay off. Mm-hmm. And then we have situations with taxing authorities, and they're often very, very difficult to deal with. A good accountant can negotiate and get the taxpayer some additional time to pay off the tax, maybe as much as a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But sometimes that's just not enough time, and we have to look at other remedies. So, and that's where a bankruptcy might be the appropriate remedy.
Right. And correct me if I'm wrong, you do both sides of creditor and debtor work, correct? Or is it on the debtor side only?
No. We represent both debtors and creditors. Mm-hmm. We represent and have expertise in representing landlords where one of their tenants may have filed a bankruptcy. I think, you know, it really makes you a better lawyer if you work both sides. So as a creditor's lawyer, I, you know, often know the games that the people on the other side can play. And frankly, because I represent so many creditors, in representing a debtor, I know what are the sensitive issues for the creditor. What are the things to avoid so as to enhance the chances of getting to a successful outcome mm-hmm. with the creditor? Because, you know, we don't want to litigate. We don't want to file bankruptcy. We want to try and find constructive solutions outside of the bankruptcy court. I tell clients that bankruptcy is just one tool in the toolbox. Sometimes it's the right tool for the job, right. But frankly, it should always be the last resort. Mm-hmm. And we should be looking for other less expensive and you know, out of court resolutions for clients. And that's what I encourage in my office.
Right, because once you file for bankruptcy, sometimes you know, the trustee comes in and takes control, and the creditors obviously have some kind of say in Chapter 11 cases mostly. So what do the debtors need to know before filing for bankruptcy? What are the potential ramifications or consequences that they need to know about?
Right. Well, and I think that's a great question, Salar. It's a great question because statistically across the country, the success rate in Chapter 11 is just a hair over 10%. It's somewhere between 10 and 11%, but I think, sorry, 10 and 15%, but I think it's closer to about 11%. So those are not great statistics.
No.
In my office, I don't keep actual statistics, but our batting average is about 85% of success rate. And the reason for that is, to track back to the question that you asked, has to do with pre-bankruptcy preparation and planning. And what that means for a company, especially a company, but also an individual who's in financial trouble, is that the earlier you go to see a lawyer who has expertise in this area, often the better off you are, because the more, frankly, the more planning that we can do mm-hmm. to enhance the chances of success. You know, a common misperception is that if you file a bankruptcy, you'll lose all of your assets. That is not true. On the individual side, there are exemptions, as you know. California's exemption laws are not the most generous in the country, but they're pretty darn good.
Right.
So that allows an individual to protect equity in a home and, you know, equity in tools of the trade and an automobile. And so exemption planning is something that we want to do with clients There may be assets that they would lose if they file bankruptcy, and we can actually legally convert those non-exempt assets mm-hmm. into exempt assets and protect the client. We don't want the client to be surprised by this process, have any unpleasant surprises. We want to try and be strategic and deliberate and really help them through what is the most difficult time probably of their lives. This, you know, financial pressure can just be really burdensome.
Absolutely. And I think that's important to do because clients appreciate that. Before we dive into the different chapters of bankruptcy, let's talk about who can actually file for bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Who are they? Persons, individuals, corporations, businesses, partnerships. You know, let's talk about that so people can listen to us.
Right. Okay. So that's I think the answer to the question is all of the above. You know, an individual can file a Chapter 7, a Chapter 11, or a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. Again, one of these misconceptions that people have is that Chapter 11 is only for companies, but individuals can file Chapter 11s, and I've been filing individual Chapter 11 cases for years, and we can talk about why one chapter versus another in a bit. Mm-hmm. And businesses can file Chapter 7 or Chapter 11. They're not eligible to file for Chapter 13 relief. That only applies to a real person, a live person.
Yes. And for Chapter 7s, both businesses and persons can do the filing, correct?
That's right. And Chapter 7 is a liquidation bankruptcy. That's maybe the simplest form of bankruptcy. I refer to it in my practice as the building block for understanding the other types of bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
And in Chapter 7, what happens is a trustee is appointed, and the trustee is a third party appointed by the court and is a fiduciary mm-hmm. for creditors. And the trustee's job is to take the assets in the bankruptcy case, in the bankruptcy estate, and try and turn them into cash so that there's money to pay to the creditors.
Yes.
And in exchange for being honest and forthright with the court about his or her or its assets and liabilities, the debtor receives a discharge, which is a wiping clean of the creditor slate.
Right.
So that's basically how Chapter 7 works. And what we want to do in the individual situation is plan the case so that all of the assets that the person owns are what we call exempt. So they're exempt from the trustee mm-hmm. and they're exempt from creditors. So what that means in lay terms, of course, as you know, mm-hmm. is that the person gets to keep all their assets. They don't lose anything in bankruptcy.
Yes.
And that's optimal. So they file the bankruptcy, they list all their assets and their liabilities. We know in advance that their assets are all exempt because we've done our homework. They go through the bankruptcy process, they get their discharge, and they keep all of their assets. And that's the sort of bankruptcy 101 for for Chapter 7 cases.
That's right. And Chapter 7s are, like you said, simple, relatively simple compared to Chapter 11s and 13s.
Yep.
Obviously, we have Chapter 9 and 12, but the main ones are the 11s and the 13s.
Right.
Now, in a 13, individuals, the filers, the debtors, have to have some kind of regular source of income. Let's talk about how that works.
Sure. So, yeah, and that's exactly right. So a Chapter 13 case is also known as a wage earner case. Mm-hmm. And that's really a little bit misleading. You have to have a regular source of income, but the courts over the years have interpreted what that means very, very, very broadly. So a regular source of income could be disability payments, could be, you know, unemployment payments.
Sure.
Might be a contribution from a family member that's regular. So it's really pretty broadly defined, but you do have to have a regular source of income because under Chapter 13, unlike Chapter 7, you're actually making payments back to your creditors over time.
Mm-hmm.
And the bargain in that the debtor, who's the person filing for bankruptcy, strikes in Chapter 13, is I will dedicate my income, my disposable income, for a certain period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And in exchange for that, I'll get a discharge. And it's a little bit of a broader discharge than in Chapter 7. You know, frankly, before the bankruptcy code was amended, it was much broader than it is now. But
sure.
Chapter 13 is really used to protect an asset like a home where a person has fallen behind and they've got equity in it. And equity is not exempt. So if they filed a Chapter 7, they might lose the house to sale by the trustee, and they wouldn't have time to catch up on the past due payments, so the creditor would probably still try to foreclose once that Chapter 7 bankruptcy was over. Where someone wants to keep their home and retain that equity, if they've fallen behind on their mortgage payments or their real estate tax payments, they can file Chapter 13 and get time using their future income to catch up on those past due amounts.
And a couple of points on that. Chapter 13s, you have a 3 to 5 year plan. So either you repay during the course of 3 years or 5 years.
Right.
So that's some time to repay your debts. On top of that, there needs to be no more than 1.5 million, I believe, 1,532,000 and some change in total unsecured and secured debts.
Hmm.
Correct?
You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me. There's actually a bifurcation, legalese. So there's there are filing limits of 13, and that's another very important distinction that you've drawn to Chapter 7. Chapter 7, you can have as much debt as, there's no limit on the amount of debt you can have. I actually filed a bankruptcy case years ago for a guy who had about $800 million in debt.
Wow.
Which was a big number. he had a very unusual circumstance, and things in business didn't work out correctly for him. Yes. But in 13, you can't have more than about $330,000 in unsecured debt, mm-hmm. and approximately $1.1 million in secured debt. So those would be mortgages, typically auto loans, that sort of thing. If you're over those numbers, mm-hmm. then you're not eligible for Chapter 13 relief, and so you can't file for Chapter 13, and that's where we get into situations where individuals often file for Chapter 11 relief. You know, if the facts of their case are suitable for a Chapter 13, but they're over the limits, we file a Chapter 11 for them. It's sort of a Chapter 13 on steroids. It's still a relatively simple case. But we can put together a bankruptcy plan, mm-hmm. like we do in Chapter 13, and get time to catch up on past due debts and maybe pay off taxes that are non-dischargeable over time, things like that.
Right. And just like you mentioned, there are different kinds of debts. Unsecured debts are typical, like the credit card debts, debts that are not secured by collateral.
Right.
And then we have secured debts like mortgages and car loans, financing basically your automobile. And we have priority liens or priority debts like tax debts, correct?
Correct.
And these numbers change. I believe the last time we checked, the debt ceiling on Chapter 13 was 1.532 million. And I guess every year or every couple of years, Congress changes that number.
Right. It's adjusted, I think, based upon cost of living adjustments. So they're minor adjustments, but we'll take whatever upwards adjustments we can get.
And also, one thing that I think is notable for our audience to know is that when they're trying to file a Chapter 13, and correct me if I'm wrong, if they are in default, basically they're late in their mortgage payments, the bankruptcy judge, the court, usually wants them to be current on their mortgage in order to confirm the plan.
Right. Correct. So the person in bankruptcy that's, let's say they're 6 months behind on their mortgage at the time that they file, needs to do, you know, a few things. With respect to the house, they've got to pay the current mortgage amount moving forward. So from the time that they file the case all the way forward, they have to pay their regular mortgage payment.
I see.
And then if they were 6 months behind on a $3,000 a month mortgage payment, so they owe a total of $18,000 in past due amounts, that can be spread over between 3 and 5 years. We used to have a lot more discretion on whether it was a 3-year plan or a 5-year plan. Again, with the last series of bankruptcy code amendments, some of that discretion was taken away. So if a person earns more than the median income for the area in which they live, then they have to do a 5-year plan. And if they're under the median, they can do a 3-year plan. But, you know, if they are eligible for a three-year plan, but they need 4 years to catch up on those past due payments, then they can propose a four-year plan. They'll get the time that they need to catch up on their past due payments.
That's good. That's good. So there's a little bit of flexibility there.
Yep.
Folks, we have Daniel Weintraub from Weintraub and Self, a professional corporation. Mr. Weintraub is a bankruptcy attorney, and he's here with us in the studio today. If you want to get a hold of him via telephone, his direct line is 310-584-7702. His website is wsrlaw.net, wsrlaw.net. And I notice you write a blog, so the blog is also wsrlaw.net/blog.
Correct.
Do you like writing the blog? How does that work out for you?
You know, I think it's... I do like writing the blog. I mean, I like keeping the website fresh and updated and putting out what I hope is valuable information for businesses and consumers. You know, the issue is, as I'm sure you find, Solar, it's hard to get to every week. and you make these grand plans you know, in the throes of a busy practice, we got to take care of client emergencies before we take care of our blogging. But I think it's important, you know, and I'd like, you know, I think that the cases that I file, you know, years ago when I started out my practice, I saw that there were firms that liked doing the real big cases. And then there were firms that are what we refer to in the profession as sort of mills that just do real small cases. And there was really no one in Southern California that was addressing the needs of the middle market. Mm-hmm. And that's what I set out to do 20 years ago. Right. And I think, you know, listen, that we look at the national statistics and the vast, vast, vast majority of businesses are not Microsoft and Apple. They're small middle market businesses that need assistance and counseling when times get tough. And we're living in, you know, economic times where it appears that, you know, Wall Street's really thriving and the big banks are thriving and we hear about how profitable they are. But I think that Main Street's still hurting. I think that, you know, moms and pops and small and mid-sized businesses are still having margins squeezed. And I think, you know, I think it's still tough out there.
It is. And that actually reminds me of bringing something up in today's show, is that let's say, hypothetically, we have a plaintiff who has obtained a default and a default judgment against a group of people and maybe a couple of corporations. Now, they have this default judgment that says they owe you $1.5 million. What are the steps and procedures? What are some things that the audience needs to listen to and know about, whether you're a business owner or not, mm-hmm. about debt collection practices?
Mm-hmm.
What are the pros and cons? What are the common pitfalls?
Of collection?
Yes.
You know, that's an interesting question. Common pitfalls, I think... are really not being aggressive enough. I think that when you have a judgment or a past due account receivable, you know, old accounts receivable aren't like good wine or good cigars. They don't get better with time. They typically get worse with time and harder to collect over time. So I think that the, you know, the squeaky wheel, I mean, all these cliches really are kind of true. The squeaky wheel tends to get the grease.
Yes.
You know, you need to be careful because you don't want to spend, you don't want to throw good money after bad
sure.
in chasing someone who may file a bankruptcy or has no way of paying the debt. But I think that being assertive and aggressive is generally the best path to collection and getting response. I mean, someone that you obtain a judgment against isn't going to voluntarily step up and write you a check. You know,
yes.
that's pretty rare. I think that's a common pitfall. And I think the other would be related, and that is, you know, spending lots of money chasing someone who really has no ability to respond to a judgment. So you want to do a little bit, if not a lot, of investigation of the people against whom you have a judgment. Make sure that there's some prospect of collection. And then, you know, one of the things you brought up was a default judgment. So it's really important that your lawyer has properly obtained the default judgment, that service of process service of the complaint was correct, service of the default notice was correct. We had a client who you and I spoke about who didn't hire a lawyer and sought a judgment, what we call in pro per, basically acting as his own lawyer. And there may be an issue with respect to whether or not the judgment against all of the defendants is in fact valid. And so, you know, you want to make sure it, sometimes clients can be penny wise and pound foolish. And you know, you and I see this over our careers all over the place. They figure, I'm not going to waste the money and hire a lawyer. I'm going to do this myself, whether it's file their own bankruptcy or do their own will and estate plan, you know, or file their own lawsuit. And then if they haven't complied with the law, they haven't, you know, followed correct procedure, they end up with a big problem, which costs a lot more money to fix than if they had come to you in the first place. And, you know, had it done correctly in the first place. So I think those are the common ones that I see.
I think so. I think you nailed it, and it's correct. People need to know that there are certain guidelines in legal procedure, whether it's in bankruptcy or otherwise. And if they don't follow those guidelines, the other parties, let's say the judgment debtors that you have a judgment against, might come back and try to reverse that judgment because of lack of procedure or failure to
exactly
comply with procedure.
Right. We actually just obtained sanctions against a big bank. We represented a company in bankruptcy that owned a piece of real estate, a 4 or 5 unit, I don't remember exactly, apartment building.
Right.
And the apartment building was over encumbered, so you know the mortgage debt was in excess of the value of the property.
Right.
So in bankruptcy, you can do something called lien stripping.
Sure.
And what we did was we went into the court with an appraisal and said, Judge, the value of this real estate is $500,000. The mortgage is $850,000. We want you to exercise your power that you have as a bankruptcy judge and reduce that mortgage down to $500,000 to the value of the property and strip off $350,000. Which the judge did. The bank wasn't very happy about it.
I'm sure not.
although they really weren't yes. proactive in the case. Hmm. And after the bankruptcy plan was confirmed, this bank hired a new lawyer. And the new lawyer came in and saw what had gone on and said, this is outrageous, and we want to reopen the reopen the case, so to speak.
Yes.
And they refused to basically comply with the bankruptcy plan. And ultimately, the judge, who is a very pro-creditor judge, he's known probably as the most pro-creditor judge on the bench down here, issued sanctions against the bank of about $25,000, all of our attorney's fees for their failure to comply. Then they continued to fail to comply, and we were just in court last week, and he awarded another $20,000 and told the bank that if they didn't get us the documentation, which was this new promissory note for $500,000, and remove the other $350,000, he was going to sanction them $1,000 a day until they got us the correct documentation.
Wow.
So
that's remarkable.
Every once in a while, the good guys really get a big win, and this you know, poor client shouldn't have had to spend all this time and all this money trying to enforce a bankruptcy plan which had been approved, and the bank slept on its rights. So there you go. Even banks do it.
Even banks do it, and you're right. It happens. We have Dan Weintraub on the air with us. You can call us at 818-602-4929 for questions. You can also find us on latalkradio.com on Channel 2. We are live here in the station.
This is really great, Salar. I want to thank you for inviting me to be your guest today. I'm really enjoying it. It's always good to see you. And you're really good. I think you've got a future in this, my friend. Maybe talk radio will come calling soon.
Thank you. Well, I'm doing what I enjoy. Believe it or not, when I practiced law and when I started the practice in 2008, I thought about the practice, and I'm sure you have done the same during the course of 20-some years. You think about what you're doing. You know, and one of my favorite people who's a public figure, Deepak Chopra,
mm-hmm.
talks about, you know, thinking and sitting down maybe a day or 5 minutes out of your day and thinking about what you're doing, who are you, and what is your purpose in this life.
Mm.
And as attorneys and people that practice law, sometimes we get bogged down with the practice of law.
Absolutely.
And it could get tiresome. It could become tiresome at some point. But I think helping people and talking to people through radio, in person, in meetings, definitely gives me a huge kick.
That's fantastic.
And sharing, you know, stories that you have and my colleagues have since November that we started this program, we've got huge, basically, followers. We've had about 3,200 or so downloads since November.
That's great.
Not even 3 months yet.
Mm-hmm.
And people are interested in this program. So as we progress, as we have your support and you're being here as a guest, I think we're developing something huge.
Excellent.
And whether or not it turns out to be something bigger than this, then we'll know.
Right.
Hopefully sooner than later.
Right. But I think what you pointed out is true, not just for lawyers, but for everybody. We get, you know, people are struggling to make ends meet. We get caught up in the rat race, even if we're doing phenomenally well. I mean, we get caught up in that rat race, and we don't take the time very often to stop and think about what we're doing and how we want to do things differently and how we're contributing and what we want to give and what we want to get out of life. You know, over the 27 plus years that I've been working as a lawyer, I've sat across the table from thousands and thousands of people having financial hardship. And often, and understandably, they're full of tremendous worry and angst. And one of the things that I've told them is, you know, listen, this is a money issue. We can make this debt go away. And ultimately, it's just about moving forward, getting employment, and getting back on your feet. And, you know, really, you got to count your blessings. You got two healthy children. You know, your wife's healthy, you're healthy. I mean, really kind of break it down to
Absolutely.
Sort of what's fundamental in life. And, you know, and no matter where you are, in the process, you got to kind of stop and smell the roses and count your blessings. Because no matter how bad the financial pressure is, believe me, I've had clients over the years where it could be worse.
It could be. It could be. And bankruptcy is an option for the honest person, debtor, who really...
The honest but unfortunate debtor is the language. Yes,
is the language.
Right.
Exactly. And Congress enacted the bankruptcy code for that purpose.
Correct.
Obviously, there are some bad apples sometimes in the bunch who try to abuse the process.
Right. Very few.
Very few. But I think going back to what you said, you know, why did we choose to become legal practitioners and engage in the practice of law, it has to be more about, you know, the recognition or the title that we get.
Absolutely.
It's because it's not a daily, you know, one day thing. We're going through this for years, like you said, 20 years for you, 20 plus years for you. And we have to figure out a way to become content for what we do and how we do it.
Right. And I don't know about you, Salar, and it'd be interesting to hear about why you chose the areas that you practice in. I, in law school, I was dating a woman whose uncle was a bankruptcy lawyer, and ultimately now he's a bankruptcy judge. And, you know, we'd have family dinners together. She and I went out for quite a while, and he would tell us stories about what he did, and it sounded fascinating. So I took a class at USC in bankruptcy law. And I was just so drawn by the fact that here's an opportunity to help businesses survive, to get a breathing space, to preserve jobs and keep people employed, and on the personal side to help them retain their assets, restore sort of financial sanity, and get a fresh start and move on with their lives. And it really seems like one of the areas to me, still after doing it for 28 years, it's the thing that turns me on, where you're actually helping people. You're making a difference. Last year, we reorganized a company that owed about $3.5 million in payroll taxes and a lot of other trade debt. And this business owner mistook revenue and a lot of revenue for profitability. Right. So this is a guy that started out a sort of, you know, mom and pop business, and over the years had grown up to, you know, several hundred employees and lots of equipment and so forth. And he was falling further and further behind on his obligations, but he's making $2 million a month. He's collecting $2 million a month. So he mistook the fact that, and he had two divisions of his company, one of which, it turns out, was losing an enormous amount of money. This this story applies to much smaller businesses as well. We in these circumstances, what we do is we bring in an outside consultant because often the CEO or the owner really is too close to his business. So you bring in a new set of eyes to give it a fresh look. And he told this gentleman, this side of your business is profitable. This side of the business is losing, you know, a few million dollars a year. And the guy said, how can that be? I'm billing and I'm getting paid all this money. And, you know, again, I think John Wooden said, don't mistake, you know, activity for accomplishment or something like that. Here it's don't mistake, you know, gross like revenue that. For profitability.
Yeah.
And we ultimately persuaded, it took a while, him to close down this side of the business. We confirmed a bankruptcy plan. He's getting 7 years to pay back a reduced amount of the payroll taxes. I negotiated a deal with the IRS where they gave up all the penalties, all the interest, and even reduced the tax a little bit and gave him 7 years to pay it off. And we collectively saved almost 300 jobs. Now, that feels like a win. Not just a win, as you were saying, like we won the case, but right. We did something good here.
Absolutely. And that's remarkable, and that's what we take with us. You know, because the legacy continues. What we do in this world resonates in eternity, hopefully. And the good things obviously stay. And, mm-hmm. you know, if we do less bad deeds, obviously, that's better for us.
Absolutely.
So in my practice, we do different things. But the main focus is internet and cyberspace law. And in that practice, in that specialty area, I focus on helping entrepreneurs start up mm-hmm. their business. If they have technology that they want to protect, intellectual properties that they need to protect, we help them with those. And on the flip side, if they are engaged in some kind of litigation or dispute with their business, with the startup company or established basically corporation or entity, we can help them resolve that process, that dispute, whether it's through litigation or informal proceedings like mediation and negotiations. So it is, again, to help people find a way to help customers get paid and develop something that is brand new, mm-hmm. Whether it's through marketing or advertising, whether it's on the internet, with e-commerce websites. I recently started helping a client who has an online auction.
Interesting.
It's online auction. It's similar to some of the established businesses, but he has a different way of doing it, and I think it's going to pick up very soon.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way for people to go online, look at the items, look at the products, and bid on them mm-hmm. through the auction process and get something for a fraction of the price.
Excellent.
With the least amount of headaches.
Mm-hmm.
So these types of entrepreneurial ideas and programs and projects are coming about in technology and internet. Thank God for Al Gore, who invented the internet, is a way for us to, you know, do what we do.
Right, absolutely. And you're really working in a new frontier because the internet is such a wide open wide open field of business and changes every day.
It's somewhat similar to the Wild West in a way, because when we go to court, sometimes the judges don't know exactly what's going on. We have to break it down technically. And the law is trying to catch up to technology because it's probably 10 steps behind.
Got it.
So it's challenging, and I like it because my background, in fact, is computer information science. And before practicing law, I worked with Fortune 500 companies, software and hardware,
mm-hmm.
Consulting with them. So that led itself to becoming what it is today.
Got it.
Going back to what you said, I think we need to talk about some items that I've listed, because I advertised and made announcements through our social media accounts that I'm going to be interviewing you today. And we talked about bankruptcy. I got some questions from prospective clients. One of them is, what is a loan modification and what can it be done, or what is the relation to filing bankruptcy?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a direct relationship? Is there an indirect relationship? How do the courts deal with loan modifications? Because we know that people try to, you know, pay up and they can't. They mm-hmm. go through hardships.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the bank and the bank says, well, you know, give us XYZ documents. We're going to review it and let you know.
Right.
And at some point, the bank is going to say, or might say, you know what? You don't qualify and we have to proceed with foreclosure.
Right.
We're not going to give you a loan modification. What are some of the remedies for the homeowners out there?
You know, in that circumstance, there's probably the only remedy. Well, I shouldn't say that because, you know, we'd have to really look at the circumstances carefully. But a remedy would be a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, as we talked about before, to get caught up on your payments through a bankruptcy plan.
Right.
You know, another remedy would be a short sale. And then, or a sale, you know, a straight sale if there's actually equity. So, you know, if you're, I have a client now who's got several hundred thousand dollars in equity in their home, and they, you know, they've had suffered some business reversals and they've fallen behind and they really can't keep the home. So what they're going to do is they're going to sell their house and they're going to buy a smaller, more affordable house.
Sure.
And they'll actually have a little bit of cash as a result of the sale. Now it's a traumatic decision. This is the home that they've raised their kids in, and it's their home. I get it. I have used the line, however, with clients because, you know, we need to really help them forward. And we as lawyers can see that if they don't move, this client is ultimately going to get sued by a bunch of credit card companies and other debt that they owe. And they're going to obtain judgments and put judgments against their home. So that equity is going to get eaten up with these judgment liens.
Sure.
I'd rather see the client get a hold of that equity and use it to the best of their benefit. They've got a kid in college, prepay a couple years of college tuition. So you have that off your plate, you know, with this money. So it's an emotional decision, but ultimately, you know, home is four walls and a roof. You can buy a smaller home, more affordable home. You can rent a home, and people shouldn't get so attached to the home. Short sales are a little bit tricky to me. They're a little bit tricky because they typically result in a buyer getting a great deal, mm-hmm. a broker making a commission.
Sure.
And I always ask the broker, well, what is my client getting? What is the seller getting? Well, you know, and what they usually say is they're going to it's better for the client's credit to have a short sale than a foreclosure. And I say, okay, I'm a lawyer. Excuse me for being asking for evidence, but really, what's the proof of that? Do you have any proof of that? And during the recession, you know, brokers had no inventory to sell. All they had was short sales. And the way that they were really marketing to folks was with this credit differentiator. You know, it's better for your credit to have a short sale. But there was, you know, we were so early in the process there, there was really no proof that a short sale stays on fewer years than a bankruptcy.
Right.
And what I was often counseling clients to do is let's try and stay in your home. You know, these are people obviously that were in real financial hardship and it wasn't like they could go out and rent a new place.
Right.
Let's see if we can stay in your home as long as possible. I may be able to keep in your house without paying your mortgage for 2 years, for 3 years, for 4 years. You'll have a roof over your head. I don't think a short sale is really in your best interest. So, you know, sometimes it gets a little testy because the brokers are, you know, chomping at the bit for that commission.
Sure.
But, you know, you and I are putting our clients' interests first always, and we got to do what's right. But, you know, loan mods are it's different than it was a few years ago. The banks are actively actually marketing loan mods. They're trying to get people to mod. So, and, you know, I think some of the reforms that were took place in California, this homeowner's Bill of Rights, which went into effect January 1 a year ago, I think it's having some benefit. Now, one of the things that was happening prior to that was banks were able to what's called dual track, so they could foreclose and simultaneously talk with you about loan mod.
Right.
So they get right up to that sale date on the foreclosure, and they call you the day before, and they say, Solar, sorry about your loan mod. We're denying it. We're going to sale tomorrow at 9 o'clock.
Right.
And that's called dual tracking. Well, now, supposedly, they're not supposed to dual track, so they have to choose to either go down the loan mod path with you or go down the foreclosure path with you, but not both.
Right.
I think that's been a positive development. And then the banks are supposed to give you one point of contact, because what was happening before is you submit your loan mod package and you call the bank, and some random person picks up the phone, doesn't know anything about your file, and that was, you know, just a colossal mess. So now there's one point of contact. That doesn't mean the bank can't change the one point of contact
Sure.
every 2 weeks or every month, and that can be frustrating for folks. But at least there's someone that theoretically has some knowledge about your file and that you can actually talk to and try and have a meaningful discussion about settlement and resolution. So that's kind of I think that's the state of sort of loan mod right now.
And you're right. It has changed. It has changed. Two things come to my mind. One thing, just to reiterate on the homeowner bill of rights, is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it's not retroactive. So if you bought
That's
your
right.
That's correct.
Yep.
So if you buy your house pre-2013, January 2013, then the Bill of Rights doesn't apply.
I'm not positive of that, Solar, to be honest with you. I kind of stopped doing... Mm-hmm. We did several loan mods, and then ultimately it just became really cost prohibitive for clients, and there were, you know, some changes in laws that were made that really made it very difficult for lawyers to get paid representing people handling loan mods. So I would actually have to go back, and wouldn't mind going back for you and looking at looking up the Bill of Rights and the homeowner's Bill of Rights, that is, and get back to you on that.
Sure. And for the audience out there who are listening, although we're lawyers, we don't know everything, believe it or not. And sometimes I get a question from a client and I say, well, I have to go research that. And she says, well, aren't you a lawyer? You should know this stuff by now. So it's not true, although we would like to know everything and not have to go back to books and research. So I would appreciate that if it's not a problem. But also, what happens, and this is a good question at least from a homeowner's standpoint or debtor standpoint, what happens after you file for bankruptcy, whether it's a 13 or a 7 or 11?
Mm-hmm.
This is something that I think the audience needs to know about.
Mm-hmm. You mean what's the actual sort of procedure? What should they expect?
What they should expect, obviously their credit score is going to drop significantly, the FICO score.
But you know what? That's really, as I've told people again over the years, that's the tail wagging the dog, Solar. We don't have clients walking into our office that have, you know, 840 FICO scores and want to file bankruptcy. That just doesn't happen. You know, usually the person's, you know, been, you know, they're behind on their mortgage for months and months and months. They're behind on their credit card for months and months and months. Now, and it's just funny. So, you know, I've laughed to myself. People come in and they, you know, it's like the person has $400,000 in past due credit card debt, hasn't paid their mortgage in a year. And one of their key questions in whether or not they should file bankruptcy is, how's this going to affect my credit? And I'm like, are you kidding? Like, what do you think your credit looks like now, number one? And who do you think is going to make you a loan now? Your credit actually, I think you become a better borrower from the lender's perspective if you file bankruptcy in that circumstance and clean the slate. Now, you don't owe any debt because no one's going to loan you money when you have a whole bunch of debt hanging out there and people can sue you, and that would impact the ability of this borrower to make payments on the new loan. So that's kind of credit. That's how I think the reality of the credit is. It's really kind of a red herring, and it is never the driving factor of whether or not someone should file a bankruptcy or not. You know, if the case has been properly prepared, if they've gone to see a good lawyer, it should be a relatively smooth ride. They go to the meeting of creditors, which sounds more ominous than it actually is. As you know, the client goes to meet with the trustee and be sworn in, and there's, you know, 50 other people that are in the room, and they get called up and asked questions, you know, are these your papers? Did you read them? Are they true and correct? Is there anything you want to tell us? And there was a series of yes, yes, no, no questions. And again, if the case has been prepared well, the client should be out of there in 5 minutes, and that's the only appearance they have to make. It's very unintimidating, and then they get their bankruptcy discharge.
Yes, that's the usual way, but sometimes things don't go that way, especially when there's some kind of fraudulent transfer or the client comes to you and talks about asset protection, and they, before they come to you, they had transferred everything to their son-in-law.
Oh, yeah.
And what do you do in those types of scenarios? I mean, we have some time to talk about asset protection. I would like to dedicate more time to asset protection because it's such a huge subject.
Right.
Maybe we can do that in the next sessions
That'd
or
be
next
great.
Segment. But let's briefly talk about asset protection. What are some of the pros and cons that you would want the audience to know about?
Right. So, and the asset protection that you just alluded to, I see all the time. You know, the client has transferred their real estate to a relative. That's not asset protection. That's a fraudulent conveyance, as you mentioned. It's also really, really easy for creditors or a bankruptcy trustee to discover because real estate has a recorded trail. So, and if you file a bankruptcy case and you don't disclose that you've transferred your assets to your son or your son-in-law, and that is found out by the trustee, not only would the property come back to the trustee, and the trustee can sell it if it's got equity, but you may go to jail.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's you know, a Title 18 of the United States Code violation, and that is bankruptcy fraud. You know, we know people that are, you know, big cases where a guy named Len Dykstra, who is a Hall of Fame baseball player, who's in prison right now for bankruptcy fraud. This is, you know, not something to be taken lightly. So here's, you know, what I want the audience to come away with about asset protection planning. It is rare that someone comes into my office when they don't have trouble and they're not facing problems and want to do asset protection planning. Usually it's when they've got had a judgment entered against them, but that's difficult. It's really best that people, before they're having difficulty, if they've got equity and assets, they should go see a lawyer and set up an asset protection / estate planning plan.
Right.
Right? It's not just asset protection. It's the estate plan that you really should have. It just has the asset protection bells and whistles on it. We can definitely talk about that in greater detail and some of the things that I do when we next meet, Salar. Thanks a lot.
I look forward to it. And again, it's a huge subject. I would love to talk to the audience and yourself about it more. Folks, we had Dan Weintraub on the air with us today. He's a bankruptcy attorney and managing partner of Weintraub and Self. His office is located at 11766 Wilshire Boulevard, Suite 1170 in Los Angeles, California. His direct telephone number is 310-584-7702, and his website is wsrlaw.net. For more information, if you would like to download the archived audio files, you can go to my website at atrazada.com and click on podcasts. You can also go to latalkradio.com and download the previously recorded files. Thank you again for listening to us today. Thank you, Dan, for being here as our interviewee.
It was my pleasure.
My pleasure, too, and we'll talk soon. Have
Great.
A good day.
Take care.
Thank you.
That mood, I can tell you what I'll do.